Now Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence Spivak. Ready for the spontaneous, unrehearsed conference of four of America's top news reporters. Here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our guest today is Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon. He is one of four senators who are candidates for the Democratic nomination for president. His first test will come on Tuesday in the primary in the District of Columbia. It is a three-way contest. His slate of convention delegates is opposed by Slate's pledge to Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota and to Adlai Stevenson. Senator Morse also was entered in the primaries in Maryland and his home state of Oregon. Senator Morse is a lawyer and the former dean of the law school at the University of Oregon. He was first elected in 1944 as a Republican. He broke away from the GOP in 1952. He became an independent, and in 1955 he joined the ranks of the Democrats. He is a member of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. Now seated around the press table, ready to interview Senator Morse, are Richard Wilson of the Coles Publications, May Craig of the Portland, Maine Press Herald, Arthur Sylvester of the Newark News, and Robert McCormick of NBC News. Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel, will be back with us 2 weeks from today. Now, Senator Morse, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. McCormick.
Let her go. Well, Senator, I'm just a little bit confused about where you do stand. In the spring of 1959, I believe, you filed an affidavit in your home state of Oregon that you were not a serious presidential candidate. And at the time, you made a rather impressive statement about how primaries should not be treated frivolously, and we should have serious candidates only in them. Are you a serious candidate or not?
Mr. McCormick, I couldn't be a more serious candidate, but let me comment upon the situation in the state of Oregon. It's true that in the state of Oregon, we have a primary law with two sections in it. One permits the Secretary of State to place people on the presidential ballot, and in order to get your name off of that ballot, if he puts you on, you have to file an affidavit. Very early in the game, so to speak, I knew that there was a movement on foot to put my name on the Oregon ballot, so I filed that affidavit because I did not think that I should go on the ballot at that time, and I thought the best way that I should indicate that I was going to support others for the presidential campaign and make my final choice at the time of the convention was to file the affidavit. But we have a second section of the law, which provides that 1,000 voters can put your name on a petition and put your name on a ballot, and you can't get it off. I think it's a very unfair law. I have protested it many times. But what happened in my case was that over 7,000 voters signed a petition, and many more would have if the 7,000 hadn't filed theirs with the Secretary of State when they did. And I tried to get them not to file that petition. But they laughed and said, listen, Wayne, if we don't file it, your enemies will file your name. Because they know if your enemies file it, you won't make a fight in the campaign. But if we put you on, you'll carry the issues to the state as our favorite son candidate. Well, so they put me on, and that's what started my candidacy.
Well, sort of a parallel to that, you said on a television program yesterday that you thought you could go into the convention with 100 delegates. Could you tell us where they come from?
Yes, let me comment upon the statement I made yesterday. I'm going to win the Oregon primary. I'm going to win the District of Columbia primary. And we're going to have a good hot race in Maryland. I'm not one of these politicians that claims something he doesn't expect to get. I think it's going to be close in Maryland. I would say as of this moment, I'm certainly trailing in Maryland, although I spoke at Frederick, Maryland last night to the largest, they said, Jefferson Jackson Day banquet they ever had, and I was pleased with the many pledges of support that came to me after that banquet.
Senator,
but now let me continue with your question. Then I have a Morse committee working in every convention state north of the Mason-Dixon line, and my people tell me they have about half the southern states covered at the present time. Now, most of your delegates at convention are going to go from convention states, not from primary states. And I want to say that a large number of my delegates are going to come from convention states, and we're getting pledges every few days from convention states from my committees there. And you're all going to be surprised the number of votes that I'll take into the convention. I think in the neighborhood of 100. And that'll be a swing vote, I think, very well, because I think the convention will be deadlocked for about 10 ballots. Anything could happen in that situation. Even Wayne Morse could get nominated for one of the two posts. And I guess I'm the only candidate who admits that he'd take the vice presidency if he can win the nomination. I have a suspicion the others would, too. But that is the way my campaign is being organized, and I'm going into Los Angeles on that basis.
Mr. Sylvester.
Senator Morse, I take it that as a serious candidate, you must have some idea of the qualifications a president should have. What are they?
Well, you know, Mr. Sylvester, when people ask me, why did you get into it, Wayne? I just took a look at the record of the other candidates and their claimed qualifications. I took a look at my own dedicated record of public service, not only of 16 years in the Senate, but 25 years in public service. And then I asked myself the simple question, why not? Why shouldn't I give the people a choice and a chance in selecting the program they want and the candidate they want on the basis of the records of the candidates? And so I'm going to conduct my campaign on the basis of the issues related to my record of public service.
You really haven't answered my question, have you?
I'm
asking you as the president, what qualifications to implement this in the form of administrative experience and other qualities should a president have?
I'll be delighted to give you what I think my qualifications are from that standpoint. Don't forget that I served in some very important posts appointed by President Roosevelt before I ever went into politics. I served in the Department of Justice for 2 years and was the editor-in-chief and director of a nationwide five-volume work on law administration. I wrote two of the volumes myself and edited the other three. I served for President Roosevelt on the old mediation board. I served on the War Labor Board. I was chairman of his emergency board on the railway strike that was settled by my mediation just a few days before Pearl Harbor. In fact, the final settlement was just the day before Pearl Harbor. I served with President Truman in various posts. In fact, President Truman once offered me the Attorney Generalship of the United States, and he laughingly says he thinks I'm the only one who ever turned down a cabinet post offered to him by the presidency. And then for many years, I arbitrated some of the major disputes of this country. And you know, there's been some comment as to whether or not I could bring conflicting forces together. I submit my record in the field of arbitration and my record in the Department of Justice as to whether I can, and 16 years in the Senate. But I quickly add this. I think the test of a presidential candidate is whether or not he's a man with courage, whether or not he's a man with a dedicated devotion to a sound constitutional liberal program, whether or not he's a man that can be counted upon not to surrender to expediency, but will lead the people of this country in what I consider to be the greatest educational office in America, namely the White House. And that calls for leadership, and I take my total public record and ask the people to be the judge as to whether I have those qualities of leadership.
Mrs. Craig.
Well, Senator, I got 2-3 questions. If you try to answer rather briefly, I'll get them all in. One is, you said that the Washington Post implied there was something wrong about your taking a $500 fee last January from a Teamsters local. Now, I want to ask you, since you are a member of the Senate Labor Committee, do you think it's right to take fees for speeches from labor unions, particularly the Teamsters?
And from chambers of commerce, and from universities, and from public forums, when the speech is sent over to the press gallery, as mine was in advance of the Toledo speech, Mrs. Craig, and you newspaper people had full notice of the content of the speech, but why don't you ask me what I said, not who I talked to? It's not important who you talk to, but what you say when you talk to them. And I want to say that these lecture fees of mine, based upon a legal analysis of the Kennedy-Landrum-Griffin law, I give to a variety of groups in the country. And I want to say that I'm very proud of what I said in that speech to this group of rank-and-file Teamsters out in Toledo. And let me tell you, it's important that my point of view get to the rank-and-file Teamsters of this country and to the rank-and-file members of other unions as well.
Well, sir, I thought you would answer it yes or no, but you didn't, so I'll go
I'm not accustomed to answer those curveball questions just with yes or no, because I know
yes,
when
sir.
I'm getting a slanted one.
I'm aware
and
of
I
that.
Always give my reasons in back of my answer.
Yes. Now, you have said that the Landrum-Griffin bill is the bill to hamstring labor, but that is not the position taken by many of the AFL-CIO. You were the only Democrat who voted against it after it was amended in its final form.
And I shall
now,
always
why
be proud.
Did you do that?
I shall always be proud of that vote. And it's interesting to see how many thousands and thousands of rank-and-file workers and local union leaders are now over to my point of view and are very critical about the fact that apparently some of the top brass of labor didn't recognize the defects of that bill before it was too late. Now, you ask me why I cast my vote. Well, it took me 4 hours and 35 minutes to cover the bill section by section in the Senate, in which I answered the defects.
Now,
but I'll just mention one, because if this were the only defect, I'll be proud of the fact that my descendants will read I didn't vote for it. And what is it? Well, as an old constitutional law teacher, here it is, Mrs. Craig. In this country, we should see to it that there is a uniform application of the law to people that fall in the same classification. And under the Kennedy-Landrum-Griffin bill, we now have the anti-labor doctrine that workers in small interstate commerce plants or workers in plants where the plant doesn't do more than $500,000 worth of interstate commerce business, and it happened to be one of those plants that the National Labor Relations Board didn't take jurisdiction over prior to August 15, 1959, are denied federal protection in a labor case.
Can I get
That's
any
a shocking proposal.
Question,
Senator? Well, no, just one second more on this, because this is pretty vital. You've asked the question, and in fairness to me, I want the people of this nation watching this broadcast to know what's happened under this bill. That means that we are sending to state courts for the application of state law, the labor welfare of thousands of workers in this country who, in fact, are working in interstate commerce plants. Now, there is no justification for doing that and giving Walter Reuther's employees out in Detroit automobile plants the protection of federal law. So I would have voted against it if all it had in it was the no man's land provision that relegated thousands of workers to state courts and state law, and under state law, remember, unions are still a conspiracy under common law doctrine in many states.
Are you saying that the 90 senators who voted for it and the AFL-CIO are less faithful to labor than you?
Oh, I'm just simply saying they suffered a serious lapse of good judgment on that occasion. They didn't study the bill. Let me tell you what happened in the Senate. Do you think that the top leaders of labor really studied that bill before that conference report
yes,
was
sir.
Adopted? Well, you're quite mistaken, because I want to tell you some of them are already issuing statements that they didn't realize all these things were in the law.
Mr. Wilson.
Senator Marsh, you spoke of speaking before our Chamber of Commerce, labor organizations, many other organizations. What is your annual income from speaking as a United States Senator?
I average about 2.5 speeches a month, putting it on a statistical basis. And my lecture fees run from $250 to $500.
So let me tell you, I plow
that money right back into my Senate desk.
How much do you take every year?
Between $10,000 and $12,000 a year. One year, I think it got up to $14,500.
I know this is not an unusual practice in the Senate, Senator, and I'm not going to suggest to you that it is or that you have done anything wrong by accepting these
fees. Well, it's a question of whether there's public disclosure.
Yes. Now, I just want to ask you about the propriety of taking this money for making speeches, which I have no doubt are in the public interest. I don't question that. But there are many ancient practices which lately have come into question. Why is it any more proper for a United States senator
to accept fees for writing magazine articles or making speeches from interests which have matters at issue before the Senate and before the federal government, why is it any more proper for them to take $10,000 or $12,000 a year than it is for some member of a regulatory agency to take a plane ride or accept entertainment from somebody who has an issue before that
agency? Let me tell you what I think the difference is. First, you got to take a look at the content of the articles written by senators and the content of the speeches made by senators to various groups, because I think as a public officer you have the duty to do what you can to educate the public in regard to these problems.
Well, you're already getting a salary from the federal government of an excess of $20,000 a year plus expenses.
Let me point out that the office expenses don't begin to cover the expenses of your office. For example, you would be surprised as to what my telephone and telegraph bill is over and above what the government provides me. If you were a citizen in Portland, Oregon, and you had an important problem, let's say you just got a visa problem, and I answered it by a franked envelope, you know what you would say. I'll send you either a telegram or I'll get you on a long-distance telephone call. And you'd be surprised the many hundreds of dollars a year that I pay out of my own pocket for airmail stamps, for telegraph bills, for telephone bills. And, of course, the test, it seems to me, Mr. Wilson, is whether or not we can get support for the full public disclosure bill that Wayne Morris has been introducing in the Senate of the United States for years, a bill that would require all public officials to disclose the amount and the sources of all their income once a year to the public. Seems to me that's the test of my good faith. But let me tell you, as long as I'm in the position I'm in, I'm going to keep myself in a position where I can serve the people of my state by this lecture fee arrangement, and I do it both through speakers' bureaus and through my office, and those fees are all publicly reported, and I'm very proud of the speeches that I make. And you people ought to be interested in what I say, not who I talk to.
All right, let me just ask you a question there. Is it not a fact that the reason you introduced the bill for full public disclosure was because you suspected that United States senators taking fees from other interests might in some way be coming too close to what their responsibilities were in the Senate?
No, you couldn't be more wrong. I introduced my bill because there was a lot of criticism as to whether or not senators were getting funds from various sources, and I thought it ought to be a matter of public record. And I've made that clear in speech after speech, and I think the people are entitled to it. I don't think your tax report is enough, because your tax report, in fact, is a secret report as far as the general public is concerned. But I think the Wayne Morris public disclosure bill is one of the most needed pieces of legislation, because it covers not only members of the Congress, it covers all public officials who earn a salary of $10,000 or more. And I think it carries out another tenet of mine, that in a democracy there's no substitute for full public disclosure of the public's business. And this is part of the public's business.
Mr. McCormick.
Well, Senator, in that connection, during the debate on the Landrum-Griffith labor bill, which I do not call the Kennedy-Landrum-Griffith bill, you introduced a set of amendments which you said had been given to you by Sid Zogry, is that his name, of the Teamsters? Well, now, if that happened in an executive department, since you have taken fees from the Teamsters for making speeches, wouldn't that be a conflict of interest case?
Well, Mr. McCormick, of course, you're not making an accurate quote of what I said. I take you to the congressional record. I walked on the floor of the Senate, and I told the Senate that I was going to introduce a series of amendments. And I said these amendments have been the result of conferences that I've had with various labor lawyers, I said, including a Teamster lawyer.
Yes, I read but they, the record,
but,
Senator.
But they were amendments that I fought for in committee, too.
And couldn't I said, you have written better amendments than a Teamster's official? I mean, aren't you enough of a qualified lawyer and legislator?
But you're not letting me finish. These were not amendments handed to me by Mr. Zogry. That's the point that you're seeking to make on this telecast, and you're dead wrong. These were Wayne Morris amendments. I pointed out that they were Wayne Morris amendments, and I pointed out that they were amendments They were worked out as a result of conferences with other senators, too. And I walked on the floor of the Senate and I said, these are Wayne Morse amendments, but I want you to know that these amendments are the product of a whole line of discussion we've had with various labor attorneys and with other attorneys as well. And I offered them as Wayne Morse amendments and pointed out, as the record will show, that we rejected a good many amendments that various groups wanted us to present too. And the amendments spoke for themselves, and I offered them only when, after my legal study, I became convinced that they were sound amendments and they were drafted with my pen and my assistants, my administrative assistants and the counsel that works with me. They were not handed to me, may I say, Mr. McCormick, by labor lawyers and introduced by request. If I'd have done that, I would have said, I'm introducing these amendments by request. I introduced them as my own draftsmanship and product.
Mr. Sylvester.
Senator Morse, in the what seems unlikely event you did become the President of the United States, what sort of people would you appoint and what sort of attitude toward the very things we've been talking about would they have?
There'd be only one test as far as my appointment's concerned, the qualification of the man or the woman. Does this person have the qualification for the post that I have the duty of fulfilling?
Do you really think that that is the full measure of a public servant?
Well, I certainly think you have no right to appoint a public servant that doesn't have the qualification to perform the job for which you're appointing him.
Does it not occur that he might have the job but might not have any sense of the fitness of his actions?
Well, you take all those subjective matters into mind, but how could you on a telecast show comment on what qualifications you were going to require from a particular individual if offered to you for the post? All I want to say is I will look upon the qualification of the person. Does he have the ability or does she have the ability to perform this job? Does she have the background of experience or does he have the background of experience? And I happen to think that's the way government posts ought to be filled. Obviously, I wouldn't appoint somebody that I thought didn't have tact. I wouldn't appoint somebody that I thought didn't have the character qualifications. I wouldn't appoint anybody that I thought was not honest. But those are all these subjective attributes that we, I think, can take judicial notice about. We all would agree upon. But the important thing is, are you appointing somebody that has the experience and the merit and the background to do the work in the public interest?
Well, you haven't actually, as a senator, had much experience in appointing people as an administrator, have you?
Well, it so happens that when I was in the Department of Justice, I had a staff in that particular project of a little over 2,000 employees under me, and we had regional offices all over this country. It so happens that when I was on the War Labor Board, I happened to be chairman of the appeal division of the War Labor Board and had a great deal to do, as the members of the board would tell you, in recommending people for appointment to regional boards and to appeal sections of the board. I've had quite a bit to do in recommending people for appointment, and I'm proud of the way the people I've appointed or influenced their appointment have worked out.
Mrs. Craig.
Senator Humphrey is criticizing Senator Kennedy for spending money in West Virginia, and you're criticizing Humphrey for the money he spent in Wisconsin. Where are you going to get the money for your...
Oh, Mrs.
Promise.
Craig, you're quite wrong. I haven't criticized Mr. Humphrey for the money he spent in Wisconsin.
But you mentioned $100,000 and said you didn't have that kind of money.
Well, that's true, but that isn't a criticism of Humphrey. I want to point out you've raised one of the most fundamental questions that face us in this matter of politics in this country, and that's why we've got to do something about the cost of elections. There's no question about it that Hubert Humphrey had to spend that amount of money in Wisconsin,
sir,
to put on an effective campaign.
I don't want to be fundamental. I want to know where you're going to get the money for all these primaries.
Well, let me tell you what my primaries are costing me. They aren't costing me anything. They're being raised by my finance committees in the three states. We expect to spend in the District of Columbia some $12,000 to $15,000 maximum. In Maryland, we will not spend more than $7,500. And in the state of Oregon, we'll not spend more than $7,500. Most of the campaigning is going to be done by Wayne Morse. And I'm going to spend such money as I have chiefly on radio and television programs.
Mr. Wilson.
Senator Morris, are you sure you will support the Democratic nominee this year, or will it be a repetition of 1952 when you were a Republican and decided to oppose Eisenhower?
Mr. Wilson, I've made perfectly clear that no matter who the Democratic Party nominates in Los Angeles in July, I will place myself at the disposal of that ticket because if they deliberately went out and tried to select somebody that could be the weakest possible candidate, he'd be 10 times better than the Republican candidate, Mr. Nixon. I want to say I left the Republican Party because I became fed up with its political expediency, and I learned the hard way that the only hope for liberalism, in my judgment, is in the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. And I want you to know I'm in the Democratic Party to stay, and I shall continue to fight for a great Democratic victory in November 1960.
No matter whom they nominate.
No matter whom they nominate, because I just got what? They're going to nominate someone out of the group of contenders, you know that. And as I said, any one of them would be 10 times better than Nixon.
Are you sure you're going to carry Oregon in the primary against Kennedy?
Well, I'm a pretty good politician, I think, when it comes to evaluating potentialities. And I'm satisfied that on May 20th, I'll win in Oregon by a substantial majority.
Well, Kennedy,
I'm sorry. I think on that we'll have to close.
I think he will.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Senator, but I see that our time is up.
Our thanks to Senator Wayne Morse, Democrat of Oregon, and the members of the Meet the Press panel for a stimulating and enlightening half hour. The panelists were Arthur Sylvester of the Newark News, May Craig of the Portland, Maine Press Herald, Richard Wilson of the Coles Publications, and Robert McCormick of NBC News. Meet the Press, produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. As usual at this time, a personal word, if I may. The President of the United States has proclaimed today, this 1st of May, as Law Day, USA. The purpose of Law Day is to build a deeper respect for law and order as the cornerstone of our American heritage. Help protect this precious heritage by respecting all laws. If you are a parent, a good way to observe Law Day, USA is to find some time today to explain to your children how our laws safeguard our freedoms. Just as sports are built on respect for the rules of the game, so is life itself. Laws are the basic ground rules which govern our daily lives, which protect our precious freedoms. Here's a Law Day pledge recommended by the nonpartisan American Heritage Foundation. I will respect and obey the laws. I will assist public officials in preventing crime. I will help the courts in giving evidence. I will serve on a jury when asked. Today, the 1st of May, join in some way in observing Law Day, USA. And so saying, I find that for me, for this...